Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They've been tagged the Three Amigos, the Interfaith Amigos, a preacher, a rabbi, a sheikh. Yes, we know, and so do they. It sounds like the setup to a joke, and they are good-humored. But these three men of faith take their interfaith work very seriously. A Christian, a Muslim, and a Jew looking to speak honestly and in friendship across lines of religion in a time when those lines can kill. This hour on Point on Christmas Eve, at the end of a rough decade of religious conflict, a conversation with the Interfaith Amigos. You can join the conversation, Can We Reach Out, across religious lines for goodwill toward men and women of all faiths. Is it high time? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll go to Washington for the latest on this morning's historic Senate passage of a health care overhaul bill. But joining me now from Seattle are the Interfaith Amigos, rabbi, pastor, and sheikh. They began to meet and talk and become friends after the September 11th attacks. Now they hold workshops and speak in houses of worship across the country. They are the authors of Getting to the Heart of Interfaith, the Eye-Opening, Hope-Filled Friendship of a Pastor, a Rabbi, and a Sheikh. Interfaith Amigos, hello, hello to you there in Seattle.
Hello to you.
Let's go one by one. Ted Falcon is a founder of Bet Aleph Meditative Synagogue in Seattle. Bet Aleph, thank you.
Right.
Recently retired there as senior rabbi. Rabbi Ted Falcon, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here, Tom.
Don McKenzie is a minister in the United Church of Christ. He also recently retired from leading the University Congregational UCC in Seattle. Don McKenzie, welcome to you.
Thank you, Tom.
And Sheikh Jamal Rahman is a Muslim Sufi minister, imam, and co-founder of Seattle's Interfaith Community Church. Jamal Rahman, thank you so much for joining us.
Salams to you.
Salams right back at you, if I may be casual.
Thank you.
But sincere. who to tell how this began, how you got together? Rabbi Ted, maybe it started somewhere in your court.
Jamal and I knew each other we were part of a board of a university that was trying to get off the ground. It was to offer a master's degree in spirituality. The university never happened, but when 9/11 happened, I had somebody to call to invite to share that week's Shabbat service with me to bring forth a different face of Islam. And Jamal joined me that Friday, and that was the beginning of our work together.
And we became, I and Ted became very good friends. We did a lot of interfaith programs, and not just the two of us, but our two congregations. And I began to realize that Ted is one of the best Muslims I know, because Muslim simply means one who is surrendered to God. But then we realized that, you know, we want to complete the Abrahamic family. We are cousins, but it's a dysfunctional family. And that's when Brother Don comes in.
Don McKenzie, here we had a rabbi and a sheikh or imam, and you came to the door.
That's right. About 6 months after 9/11, Ted called me. I knew him from another venue and wanted to know if I wanted to join Jamal and Ted in a project to mark the first anniversary of 9/11. And I said yes, and we had it at my church. And after it was over, we looked at each other and said, well, we can't stop now, not having any idea what that would mean, but we did start to meet weekly. We started to do interfaith spiritual direction for each other. We started speaking in churches and synagogues and mosques and so forth, and we wrote a book. We took a trip to the Middle East, and here we are.
The Interfaith Amigos, and right at the top of your book, you say it's a matter of survival. That's about as high stakes as we can point to. Ted Falcon, a matter of survival? Why? What?
Well, we believe that the kinds of issues that are facing the world today require a concerted response that can only happen when all of us start talking to each other, start entering into deeper dialogue toward deeper collaboration. And we feel that spirituality is one of the foundations which can become the ground for that expanded dialogue.
Don McKenzie, you in the book, you say, in our day, it appears that religions are at the heart of some of the world's most brutal conflicts. Survival depends on this conversation, Don?
It does, because for the last several thousand years, religion has often been used as, people have drawn on the authority of religion to justify violence and hatred. It's not the substance of religion, because the substance of religion does not condone violence and hatred. But in other words, so often some of the problems that we're facing are problems that really have money and power and self-esteem in them, but they're disguised as religion. And so part of our role is to try to help to uncover that and show how it's working.
Jamal Rahman, when you take this message as the Interfaith Amigos out into the world, and I know you do that a lot, where do you hit the most skepticism, and where do you get the most, the biggest welcome?
The biggest welcome is with the young people and also the older people, the young people who don't have that cultural baggage and the older people who have this treasure of wisdom, and they realize that really God is greater than any one religion. The greatest obstacle are the people who are most skeptical, are the ones who are most attached to their institution. You know, we like to say that spirituality is the water in a cup, and some people are very, very attached to just polishing the outside of the cup, and we forget the message inside. Mm. And so they who are so attached, they feel that this interfaith will dilute their own tradition. We believe the opposite is true.
Don, what does interfaith mean to you, mean to the three of you, if you have a shared understanding of it?
I think interfaith means making or being willing to penetrate the seemingly impenetrable walls that surround each of our traditions, to locate three things. One would be the universals that transcend those boundaries, the things that we really have in common that rest at the core of each of our traditions. Second, the particulars in each of our traditions that support those core teachings. And then third, the particulars that don't, the things that we call the untruths, which is what Gandhi called them.
And we're going to talk about those, and you all are all wonderfully candid on all those fronts. Ted Falcon, do you get an open reception to this, or does the fact of your, you know, interfaith friendship depend on, when I look at your backgrounds, you're each, Jamal Rahman is a Sufi, kind of, we think of as a liberal wing of Islam. You're in kind of the liberal end of Judaism, donned with the United Church of Christ, kind of the liberal end of Christian faith. Does it depend on where you started from? Is that what made this amigoship possible?
It's a good question, Tom. And it's hard for me to answer it because I'm kind of inside it. From my own experience, there was a point in my life where I awakened to a realization of what it meant to have one. That one God was not something out there, but we all are part of the one. We are sharing one life. We are sharing one being. We are sharing one presence. And ever since that time, it became clear to me that each spiritual tradition, each religious tradition at its highest is an avenue to that shared universal. Did that come out of my liberal background? It's hard for me to say. It came out of a very deep set of experiences which demonstrated to me the importance of learning to speak to each other about that which is really important and find ways of entering into a dialogue about those things which appear to be irreconcilable, those things which separate us.
Jamal Rahman, there are a lot of fundamentalists in this world, in all three of your faiths and others. Can fundamentalists participate in interfaith? I'm not sure what the right word is. Dialogue seems kind of soft here, but in interfaith connection?
Islamic fundamentalists, if you call them that, they, like any other Muslim, they want to see what the writing is in the Quran, for example, in the Quran. Mm-hmm. And so to those people, I show them those universal verses in the Quran. There are several verses that say that if God wanted, God could have made all of us one single community. But God chose, out of a deliberate design, to create differences and diversity for one reason, that you might get to know one another. So I show them those verses. I tell them what Prophet Muhammad said, that religion is 9/10 of it is about relationship with the other and 1/10 relationship with God. Mm. So, you know, based on the scriptural insights, plus, most importantly, creating a personal heart-to-heart, one-to-one friendship, a relationship, a connection, without wanting to change the other. That is the key. If we do that, I think there's a good chance that we can still be friends, even though we have differences.
Don McKenzie, we've just got half a minute before the break, but what's your experience? Christian fundamentalists open to your message of interfaith dialogue or not?
Well, I think probably not particularly, but we are very interested in initiating conversations with people to help them to see what we have found and to hear what their experiences are. And I think that's crucial to try to overcome the we-they that has been so typical of our relationships.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On this Christmas Eve, we're talking with a pastor, a rabbi, and a sheikh or imam tackling the religious conflicts of our time. They call themselves the Interfaith Amigos. Rabbi Ted Falcon, UCC Minister Don McKenzie, and Jamal Rahman, a sheikh imam in the Sufi communities. He's a minister and co-founder of Seattle's Interfaith Community Church. They all three join us from Seattle. They're authors of Getting to the Heart of Interfaith, and they have now put years into the work of traveling around the country, talking about and acting out, reaching across lines of faith. Don, Ted, Jamal, we have a lot of calls. Let me go straight to Nashville, Tennessee, and Ron. Ron, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you today?
Very well, Ron. What's on your mind?
Well, let me prep the question with this. I serve in the military as a chaplain, so mm-hmm. I am constantly around folks that are different than I. Mm-hmm. Which is good, and I admire the work that these gentlemen are seeking to do, reaching across lines and working together for the good of those around them. Appreciate those things. My question is this. With the differences in your faith, as I understand, you seek to look for those things that are common, but it seems as though historic Christian faith has a completely different view of the person and work of Christ, Jesus. So how do you work that issue in your relationships and in your work together? How do you settle on that? Is it one of those things that you agree to disagree on and work together in spite of, or how do you balance that? I'll take my response off the air, if that's okay.
Thank you very much, Chaplain Ron. Don McKenzie, let me come to you with that. You've got it right in the book, and of course it's in the Bible, in the New Testament, Jesus saying, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." That sounds like a pretty tough and maybe exclusive, deliberately, message. What about Ron's question?
Yeah, that's a great question. And Chaplain Ron has a great experience dealing with his own faith in the context of others, which is what we're doing here. My sense of that statement in the Gospel of John, "No one comes to God but by me," is the early church defining and defending itself against its perceived enemies at the time, namely Jews, Gnostics, and pagans. And I think that Jesus, in his ministry, would have been deeply concerned to put a lot of energy under the idea of oneness, the thing that Ted was talking about earlier that comes from the time of Moses. We are all part of the same thing. On the other hand, I would say, for me, Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. I'm a Christian person. That's my path. And so, obviously, I take the person and role of Jesus differently from the way Ted and Jamal do at a particular level. But I would say the three of us look to what Jesus is trying to do and see it connecting to those universals that really bind us. They don't just touch us. They really bind us. And so anytime one has an opportunity to hear about the spiritual path of another person and listen to it without negative judgment, and then ideally share one's own spiritual path, is a very deep and precious moment, and it helps to overcome that we-they sense that has been so defining for religious traditions.
Rabbi Ted, what about it? In every faith, we can find things that seem awfully divisive. You know, one way to God, you can hear there in the New Testament. The chosen people in Judaism can sound that way to ears outside of Judaism. Is it all the same? Do those things not matter? How do you deal with the fences that seem kind of built in?
Well, there's two basic ways, Tom. First of all, if we identify a core teaching in each of our faiths and the teachings and practices that support that core teaching, then we kind of know what the faith is for. What it is that we are striving to bring to ourselves and to the world. Then there are going to be aspects in every tradition that are more exclusive, you know, particularly as the institution builds up and defends itself, you know, its own survival becomes often primary rather than serving simply the spiritual path. Within Jewish tradition, for example, the idea of the chosen people is very clear in the Torah. The only chosen people, which I think is an unfortunate way of looking at it. It seems clear, looking more deeply into Jewish tradition, that Jews are the people called for the way called Torah. Christians are called for the way of Jesus. Muslims are called for the way of Muhammad. Each of us is equally called to the integrity, to the wisdom, and to the beauty of the teachings of each of our traditions.
Are you talking about blending and melding traditions here? When you talk about the one, I think listeners could get the sense that it's kind of all the same. Is that
no,
what you're...
Mm-hmm. What we are saying, essentially, is that every spiritual path, every authentic spiritual path, leads to a shared universal. That universal is bigger than any path. That universal is not owned by any path. That universal, one might say, owns every path. God is the only being who can celebrate all religious traditions at the same time. God is the only being who can celebrate all relationships at the same time. We are more limited, so we need to find a relationship in which to find meaning in our lives. We need to find a spiritual path. That spiritual path may be a recognized religious path, or it may be something that is new to a particular time.
Jamal Rahman, we've got questions coming in for you as well. Jason, also in Nashville, Tennessee. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. And panel. Thank you so much for another wonderful show. This conversation is so important. There is one passage in the Quran that I can't get past sometimes in this greater dialogue, and it says in the Feast 551, O believers, do not hold Jews and Christians as your allies. They are allies of one another, and anyone who makes them his friends is surely one of them, and God does not guide you. I'm sorry, God does not guide the unjust. I know that probably finds its way in more fundamentalist approach to things, but in the greater dialogue, when you all, if you have, dealt with this, how do you deal with that? And I'll take my answer off here.
Thank you, Jason. Jamal Rahman, everybody has tough questions here. Don, Ted, and you.
Yes.
What about Jason's question?
Actually, that's a very, very good question. I'm glad he pointed out to that particular passage. This is a good example of a verse which can easily be taken out of context. I tell you why. This is a particular verse that relates to a particular battle in a historical context in the 7th century when the Jews and Christians had a treaty with the Muslims. At the last minute, the Muslims claim, they reneged on that. That's when the revelation came. It's not a universal verse because in the same chapter, if you go, I think, 16 verses down, there's another verse which is a universal verse which says, it doesn't matter if you're a Christian or a Jew or a Sabian or a Muslim. What takes you to heaven is having faith in God, believing the last day of judgment, but most importantly, doing righteous deeds. And this is emphasized again and again and again in the Quran that what takes you to heaven, whether you're male or female, doesn't matter what your religion is. I repeat, doesn't matter what your religion is, the Quran says, in theory. What takes you to heaven is having faith in God, being accountable, but most importantly, doing righteous deeds. That is the universal verse we want to focus on. And my friend who asked that question is very correct. A lot of extremists in Islam have used that particular verse to justify their beliefs and their actions, wrongly, I would say.
What about, I mean, everybody here has got a lot of candor. You've got a whole chapter where you each sort of open your, well, I'm sorry, but clerical robes about what's difficult. You know, Rabbi Ted says, what troubles me in the Jewish tradition? Then a whole segment on it. And in addition to what he affirms and embraces there, Don, what I'm uncomfortable with in the Christian tradition. Jamal, what I find awkward in Islam. And you point directly and straight away in that segment, Jamal Rahman, to the sword. Verses,
yes,
widely quoted, and for a lot of people around the world, a source of discomfort. What cite those for us, and what do you say
yes.
to them?
You see, that again is an example where it can be taken out of context, but we have to go deeper into that. The verse says, kill the unbeliever. It sounds absolutely awful.
Yes, it does.
But if you look at it in the historical context, and I'm not trying to justify mm-hmm. it, people usually leave out the verse which precedes that. In that particular one, it says, begin not hostilities, for God loves not the aggressors. There's a verse after that which says that if the enemy asks for peace, you must lay down your arms and immediately go for peace, because God loves those who restrain themselves. But what I am saying, what we are saying, a lot of Muslims are saying, is that even if you factor in the historical context, even if you factor in the pre and post verses, it is still a particular verse that has a historical place and context. It's very, very awkward, and that does not relate to the universal verse, because there's so many other universal verses which really is the norm, which is the path we should follow. This is a particular verse having a historical context of a place and time.
We've had the attacks of 9/11.
Well,
I just wanted to ask, because we've had the attacks of 9/11. We had the killings at Fort Hood recently and found the writings of that poor officer who was so troubled and finally opened up with the gun. I mean, do you get the toughest questions, Jamal Rahman, when you're before Christian or Jewish audiences or general audiences? You know, are you the guy taking the really hard stuff or not?
Oh, sure. But, you know, these are people who really want to understand. Like, this particular verse is brought up many, many times, and we say that we have to, because it is a particular verse, view it from a higher perspective, deeper consciousness, higher understanding. The Quran says every single verse has many levels of meaning, and some are literal, some are metaphorical. It gives us creative ways to look at it with a higher consciousness. And we have to start doing that rather than evade, avoid, and be bogged down in contorted postures of defense.
Ted Falcon, when you take your roadshow to Jewish temples around the country, are people, you know, accepting of this sort of take the high road idea, or pointing out to tough realities around the world and saying, where's the beef?
Interestingly enough, Tom, so far the response has been surprisingly positive. We have been waiting for those who radically are offended by what we are saying, by what we are doing, and that really hasn't happened yet. Our next book is focusing on dialogues with people who are more fundamentalistic or more orthodox in their belief systems, and really experiencing the dialogue, probing what's possible in that realm. But so far, it's been surprisingly joyful.
Makes it sound easy. We know, in fact, it's not. We know.
Yeah, I could say, you know, you yeah. asked the question to Jamal.
Yes.
Jamal has an added responsibility of teaching people about the basics of Islam, because the American population is by and large ignorant about what Islam is about.
Mm.
Don and I don't have that. Don and I have issues of struggle between Christians and Jews, Christianity and Judaism forever.
Mm-hmm.
We have that to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an exciting process to enter into this dialogue and to welcome those things that are that people have questions about.
And as you say, survival may depend on it. Let's get a call from Cranston, Rhode Island, and Shoba. Shoba, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a huge fan of the show, and I listen to it every morning. I just wanted to make a comment. It's a very interesting discussion I'm listening to from three perspectives of three different faiths. I just find it conspicuously absent that nobody from the Hindu religion has been invited to make any contribution to this discussion. I'm from India. I'm a follower of the Hindu faith, and I see so many points of commonality. The point a previous speaker made about how the paths to the Lord are all the, they're different, but ultimately it is the same God that we're all focusing on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, I'll take the comments off the air. I'm not, my comment is not specific to anybody, but I feel in this discussion the Hindu religion should have been represented.
Where's the Hindu? Shobha, we've got it, and I appreciate your call very much. I mean, at one level, we take our amigos where we can find them. On the other hand, Don McKenzie, I mean, is there something, is even this an exclusive club? You, as noted, these are all Abrahamic religions. Is there a reason you don't have a Hindu or a Buddhist at the table, sort of, you know, four amigos, five amigos? You know, pick your number. Is the tent big enough for all ultimately here?
I think that that's a very important point. And not only do we need to be speaking with and among Hindus and Buddhists and others, but with women. And when we got together, we had no idea where this would take us. If we had gotten together and said, let's create the perfect interfaith thing,
yeah,
we would be probably more than we are. But I think what we thought then, and especially given the problems and the drama of 9/11, that it was important for the Abrahamic faiths to be talking to each other. And that's what we've been doing. And we hope that what we have discovered and learned from each other can be shared with people from other faiths, and we can hear from them about how they respond to that and, you know, how it's possible to have conversations that cross those lines too. That's crucial in the long run. We're just getting started.
How many years into this are you now? What, four, 5 years into this?
Eight years.
8 years into this project.
We are often, Tom, on programs and in dialogue with Buddhists and with Hindus. The particular reason, I think, why the Abrahamic traditions are so important are because we're the ones who are having trouble. We're not having trouble right now in this country or in our part of the world with Hindus or with Buddhists. We're having trouble with the dialogue between Muslims and Christians and Jews. And I think that's where our work is.
And Tom, if I may just say so,
yes, Jamal.
To answer Shobha, we as people of the Abrahamic faith, we quote Gandhi continuously. If I may just quickly reiterate or say again that Gandhi is a fantastic guide for interfaith. He used to make 3 points, and we quote him all the time. Number one, he said, it is a sacred duty of every individual to have an appreciative understanding of the other person's faith. Point number two, let's acknowledge every single religion has truths and untruths, especially your own. Third point, if somebody commits a wrong, violence, don't criticize his or her religion. Point out to this person verses of and insights of beauty and wisdom from this person's own tradition. Help this person to become a better Muslim, Hindu, Christian, Jew. That's the way to peace, said Gandhi.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour on Christmas Eve with a pastor, a rabbi, and a sheikh or imam who are tackling the religious conflicts of our time. They call themselves the Interfaith Amigos. Rabbi Ted Falcon, Pastor Don McKenzie, Sheikh Jamal Rahman, they join us from Seattle. They've written a book called Getting to the Heart of Interfaith. Let's get a call right off the top here from Camden, South Carolina. David, you're on the air.
I was curious to see what these three gentlemen had to say about after this life and what happens after we die. And I wanted to leave them with this verse, chapter 5 of 2 Corinthians. And it says, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body, according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad." Thank you.
Thank you, David. Don McKenzie, to you. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. There we are again. Is that insurmountable? How do you deal with it? What about the afterlife?
It's not insurmountable, but certainly from my point of view as a Christian, that would be one way to say something about what happens next. But it certainly wouldn't be true for Jamal or for Ted. I mean, what's being said here is a particular way, but it points to the fact that life does not end with death and that healing will come in various ways from the hand of God. From a Christian point of view, of course, that is revealed to us through the person and teachings, the death and resurrection of Jesus. So I see that both in a particular sense and in a universal sense, and it's a great point. I mean, this is one of the questions that we've been surprised to find. The people have curiosity, don't we all, about what happens when we die? And so we appreciate the question.
But I sense that David's question carries in it a kind of accusation that you're ignoring something written in Scripture here that he's not sure is surmountable. I mean, Ted Falcon, through the centuries and more, verses like this and others we've cited today have led to all kinds of conflict and suffering. And it's still there in verses. People are always going to be out there who cite and go to that more exclusive view. How do you propagate a bigger view? Or does religion necessarily sort of, snap back to a form that's adversarial?
Great, great question. Because religion creates an institution, every institution has its own survival as its priority. In order to ensure its own survival, it tends to want to demonstrate that it is the best. It is the only, it is the way. We carry around our own individual institutions with us, and that individual institution is called the ego, which rather than functioning to channel a fuller consciousness into our world, often usurps the show and wants to run the whole thing on an ego level without any awareness of a greater depth. As long as we are human beings with that capacity and with that difficulty, that will be mirrored in our religious institutions. There are so many verses in our scriptures, and certainly in Jewish traditions, so much writing, that the writing that's chosen to use as a particular talking point or as a particular foundation for argument largely depends on the ego needs of the person who's doing the reading. So we can find verses that are totally exclusive and we can find verses that are totally inclusive. Well, which one is a reflection of the ego of religion and which one is reflective of the essence, the substance of a faith?
Jamal Rahman, I hear that, and at the same time, the question still kind of stands there, whether the religions themselves are the vehicles that carry the seeds or the armor and the weapons of conflict. You can, as Rabbi Ted Falcon says, you can cite things that are open and things that are quite closed. Is this an endless cycle then of adversarial views that we're stuck in?
Quite often when there is this adversarial relationship and we quote a religion, we'll find that this is not religion speaking, this is ego speaking, our little self.
Politics.
Absolutely. For example, this militant Islamic theology is not based on Islamic principles, it's based on political radicalization, as you say. And I think the crucial point that is ignored by practitioners of religion is that religion enjoins us, really asks us to do what is called the inner work, the inner development. In Islam, it's about the transformation of the ego, and that's very specifically mentioned in the Quran. It's about opening up the heart and then being of service to God's creation. This is the reason why we are here. So we have this wonderful insight that, you know, people will talk about religion, people will fight about religion, people will kill about religion. They'll do everything but live it because it is so inconvenient. But that is what primarily religion asks us to do that inconvenient work.
Don McKenzie, it's got to be tough sometimes. I've just got you guys for a few more minutes, but I'm sure this hasn't all been sweetness and light. What's toughest for you? You've worked hard on this. You're committed to it. We hear it. When's it been toughest for you three personally?
Well, I think the moments when we suddenly realized we were in a moment of disagreement and really didn't quite know how to handle it. I mean, we started out with an intuition that we were probably all headed in the same direction. But there have been a couple of times when suddenly we've been up against a wall. And literally it happened when we were talking about the chapter we wrote about our trip to the Middle East. And Jamal had written a sentence describing his view of the security wall between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, between Israel and the occupied territories. Mm-hmm. And Ted heard that and said, if that's in the book, I can't be in the book. And there was silence, and you could almost hear three hearts beating. And then as we began to talk about that, and we each took a deep breath and so forth, we realized that that difference in perceptions is exactly why we are doing our work, to try to understand what that difference is all about. And so we took that to be, instead of an insurmountable problem, which it seemed to be initially, we took that to be an opportunity to try to understand what it felt like to be Jamal, what it felt like to be Ted, and to take that to another level and say it's always important in speaking to another human being to try to understand what it feels like to be that person. That's something that actually is supported by spiritual and religious values, but has not been a practice particularly of any religion.
You know, we may not get to the bottom of this on this Christmas Eve, but we've just got you all for a couple of more minutes. I wish you'd each be gracious enough to leave us on this particular day with a blessing from your own faith that speaks to the goals that you have in mind in your project, in your Interfaith Amigo project. And Rabbi Ted Falcon, I'll come first to you. I mean, what sort of blessing or what word speaks to what you're trying to accomplish here? From Judaism.
The essential word in Judaism is oneness. I'm particularly aware of the time we are talking. The world is about to enter into Christmas. Christianity is the largest religion in the world, probably not for long because Islam is fast growing. And Christmas is often a difficult time for Jews. Often it's a joke. Jews on Christmas go for Chinese food and movies.
Right.
But I think it is possible to honor part of the spiritual essence of Christmas without entering into the particulars of Christian faith. This is a season that talks about the birth of something beautiful. And that birth can be something beautiful within each of us. It could be within each family. What do we want to birth in our families? What do we want to birth in our communities? And what do we want to birth in our world this year that not only speaks of a greater peace, that not only speaks of opening the hearts, but walks that peace and walks that love into the world? So the blessing from my tradition would be a blessing of love and a blessing of oneness and a blessing of awakening and a blessing of hope.
Jamal Rachman, our time is almost up here. In a word, in a line, what blessing can we have from you?
You know, maybe just a verse of the Quran. The Quran says, God will not change the conditions of a people unless they change what is in their hearts. My aspiration, my hope is that we all really, truly open our hearts and really practice inclusive spirituality.
And Don McKenzie, a Christmas Eve blessing in this interfaith spirit from you, sir.
Well, I think of the fifth chapter of Paul's letter to the church at Rome, where he says, suffering produces endurance, endurance produces character, character produces hope, and hope does not disappoint us.
Hope does not disappoint us. It's a good message. We'll take it for this day. The Interfaith Amigos have been with us in this hour, authors of Getting to the Heart of Interfaith. Jamal Rahman, Ted Falcon, Don McKenzie, all in Seattle. Thank you for your friendship and thank you for your time today. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, the U.S. Senate's historic vote today on health care. This is On Point. At 7:16 this morning, the Senate's health care overhaul bill passed 60-39. No Republicans voted for the bill. Here's Vice President Joe Biden announcing the tally.
The yeas are 60, the nays are 39, H.R. 3590 as amended, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is passed.
Joining us now from Washington for Insight is Noam Levy. He covers national health care policy for the Los Angeles Times. Noam Levy, thanks so much for being here. What hath the Senate wrought, Noam?
Well, it's a big bill, 2,500 plus pages, but probably the most far-reaching piece of healthcare legislation that that this country has seen in almost half a century.
You watched as it finally came down. What did you see in the event on the floor of the Senate?
Well, there were a lot of tired senators down there. The Senate's been in session for 25 straight days. A lot of long nights. There have been pretty bitter partisan bickering and sniping over the last few days as Democrats tried to get this bill through before Christmas. So by the time it actually came to a vote, the speeches were mercifully short, and they proceeded to a rather dramatic roll call vote from their desks, something that the Senate does very rarely. Before the healthcare debate, it happened only really when there were impeachments and the like. But as this fight got more and more bitter, Democrats insisted on this kind of vote, which does pump up the drama.
Senator Robert Byrd, 92 years old from West Virginia, stepped outside regular protocol. Not just an aye, but this is for my friend Ted Kennedy, he said with his aye. What about from the Republican side and protocol here? You know, are we in new territory on how senators are relating with one another, Noam?
Well, it's certainly there is a lot of chatter around the Capitol that things have really deteriorated pretty far. Usually, the Senate has prided itself on being the more deliberative body than the House, which can be rowdier. But it is there has been a partisan edge to what's been going on in the Senate over the last few months, and there's some degree of worry that may carry forward. This may be something new.
Edge, to say the least. What percentage? Everybody talks about this as the biggest legislation since the 60s, or maybe since Social Security itself, all the way back in the 30s. What percentage of Americans are going to be affected by what's just been passed and what's likely to unfold on?
Well, I think it is fair to say that almost everyone will be affected, but some will be affected more than others. I mean, the most immediate or the biggest impact will be on those probably who don't have health care right now, who ultimately will be able to get insurance. That's a relatively slow process. It won't start until 2014. But by 2019, the estimate is that 31 million more people who wouldn't normally have health coverage will have it. That's pretty dramatic, you know, 10% of the country. There also will be smaller changes happening that may ultimately be felt more broadly in the way that we all get medical care. Part of the smaller and less debated parts of this bill are changes in the way that the federal government pays for health care, with an idea that federal government can use Medicare to incentivize hospitals, doctors, and other providers to not only be more efficient in the way they deliver care, but also to deliver better care, to use research that suggests best outcomes and so forth. And that ultimately could affect everyone.
31 million uninsured to be insured by 2019. Reports are that would still leave 23 million people uninsured in this country. Who would they be, Noam?
Well, there are a certain number of people who typically will not sign up for programs. We see now that there are an enormous number of people in this country who are eligible for public assistance in health care alone, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, for a number of different reasons, cultural and other. People don't sign up for those programs. There's a certain number of people who won't do that. There are also undocumented immigrants who aren't eligible for the benefits in this bill. most of them, and presumably they will continue not to have health insurance, many of them, and presumably there will still be a fair number of undocumented aliens with us even 10 years from now.
But for most people, if this goes through conference with the House as expected, there will be a mandate that they have health insurance. When does that, under the bill, when does that mandate kick in?
Well, the mandate kicks in when the, will most likely kick in when these new insurance marketplaces or exchanges that we've heard so much about go into place. The bill envisions that in 2014 in the Senate, in 2013 in the House, that states and or the federal government will create new marketplaces in which insurance companies will have to enter to sell their products to people who don't get benefits through work. And those marketplaces will regulate the kinds of benefits that insurance companies charge, and potentially even how much they charge, although that's still some subject of debate. When that goes into place, there will be a mandate, as you mentioned, a requirement that all Americans, with some exceptions, would have to buy insurance. That's one of the more controversial and potentially one of the more far-reaching impacts of the bill.
That's still 3 or 4 years away, but soon it appears on its way, and everybody streaming out of town in Washington, D.C. Noam Levy, thanks so much for joining us today with that report from Washington. Noam Levy with the Los Angeles Times. Noam, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. We hope you have great holidays and year-end. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.